This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. We'll begin today with the gun industry versus Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey. Massachusetts gun shops and the firearms industry have filed suit in federal court against the attorney general, calling her crackdown on so-called copycat assault weapons unconstitutional. At issue is Healey's enforcement action last July, which expanded the list of prohibited weapons under the state's assault weapons ban. Here's Larry Keene, vice president and general counsel with the National Shooting and Sports Foundation, which represents the gun industry.
The attorney general, on her own, without any legal authority, has decided to reinterpret the definition of what constitutes an assault weapon in Massachusetts. It was not done by the legislature, and her definition has no basis in the statute and is inconsistent with the legislative history and intent.
Keene calls the Attorney General's enforcement directive on assault weapons vague, ambiguous, and unconstitutional.
She is hurting small mom-and-pop businesses in the state of Massachusetts that comply with the law. She has a personal viewpoint on the issue of gun control, and we respect her right to have that opinion, but she cannot misuse her office to advance her own personal political agenda.
Now, we heard from the Attorney General on this issue this week on Radio Boston. She told us her enforcement action is consistent with Massachusetts law and is aimed at stopping sales of weapons that have been slightly modified in an obvious effort to get around the state ban on assault rifles.
The sale of that kind of weapon is actually banned under Massachusetts state law, but yet 10,000 of those very weapons were sold in this state last year alone. They made copycat versions of these assault weapons. They even went so far as to market on their website that these weapons were, quote, Massachusetts compliant.
So let's jump right into our Friday Week in Review, beginning with the legal debate over assault weapons in the state. And this week, our Week in Review panelists include Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute. Jim, great to see you.
Good to see you, too.
And John Carroll, Professor of Communication at Boston University and WBUR Senior Media Analyst. John, always good to have you as well.
Always good to be here.
So I'll start with you, John. Obviously, this argument is going to come down to what the legislative intent was and what the statute actually says about assault weapons and copycat assault weapons. But do you have any sense of, in this early going about who's right here?
Well, I got my legal degree from the Jerry Orbach School of Law, so I don't think I'm really an expert on the legal aspects of it.
Well, you're one degree ahead of me.
There you go. But I think that this is going to be an interesting tug of war, because what we see at the federal level with Barack Obama doing executive orders left and right because the legislature isn't willing to move on something, we're seeing here as well. I'm assuming that Maura Healey went this route because she didn't think that the legislature was going to take a bite of this apple. So I think that that just having this on the radar screen is a good thing, whether she wins or loses, because I think that there's a lot of talk about violence going on, but there's very little action. At least this puts the issue on the front page. And then one last thing. It's always interesting when major industries pull out the mom-and-pop stores to make their case. I'm not sure this is about mom-and-pop stores as much as the firearms industry in general.
Well, it's interesting because, in fact, it was the slaughter at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando that prompted Healey to issue this directive. She said that the sale of the kind of weapon that is banned under Massachusetts law. It was the weapon that was used in Orlando was banned under Massachusetts law, but literally thousands of virtually identical versions of this gun are sold every year here in the state. So that's what she was concerned about. Jim, what do you hear in this debate?
Well, I didn't even get my degree. I flunked out. So, look, the Massachusetts legislature historically has been very active on this issue. We have some of the tightest gun laws in the country, and the state seems quite happy with those. And what I'd say is this is one of those things that, frankly, the courts are going to have to sort out. It gets into an interpretation of one-off weapons and whether they fit the definition of what has already been banned by the legislature.
Yeah. Well, there's something that both sides agree on in this debate, and it's the effect of Healey's enforcement action. Here she is talking to us earlier this week about that.
The good news is that we're about 2 months out from that enforcement notice, and sales of those weapons have essentially stopped here in the state.
So the gun industry actually agrees with that. When I was talking to Larry Keene today, he said she's right about that, and that's a problem as far as they're concerned. But Jim, let me come back to you. John talked about no action in the legislature. Of course, the Massachusetts assault weapons ban was passed back in 1998. Is the legislature going to eventually have to sort of step in and resolve this, or is this going to be left up to the courts? What do you think?
I think it's going to be left up to the courts in the short term, and it may want the legislature might want to step in afterwards and address it once again, but I think the courts will decide this one.
Yeah. Well,
the other way that people could go is through a ballot initiative, and I think that if this does fail in the court, it may be a route that that the gun control people would take. Ballot questions are becoming more and more the vehicle for public movements, for more community-based movements.
It's an interesting debate. I mean, when you talk to the folks of the gun industry, they say, look, the assault weapons have been defined a certain way for the last 20 years, and their claim is that Morihili has sort of expanded the definition without authority. But if you look carefully at the definition of what an assault weapons ban is in the state statute, which I did today, it sort of got me thinking that because it's been interpreted a certain way for the last 20 years doesn't necessarily mean that that's the correct way. I mean, I'm not weighing in because, like, I don't have one of these degrees either, and I'm happy to leave this
up to the court. Set a pretty high standard here, haven't I?
But I do get the sense that this is a really interesting debate, and it'll be interesting to watch how the courts weigh in on it.
Well, it's clear that the gun industry is trying to make an end run of the law, and I think that, their interest in that is obvious, but also the public interest in not letting them do that is also obvious. And I think that you have the letter of the law and the spirit of the law. And I think they're certainly, if they're within the letter of the law, they're certainly violating the spirit of the law and taking advantage.
Yeah, I think one part of this argument, it sort of comes down to if it quacks like a duck and walks like a duck, it's a duck. And I think what Morihili is saying is no matter what if you make these minor adjustments to these guns, they still have a lethality that knows no bounds, and they need to be stopped.
Yeah, it's also an important test for a new court in how they will interpret this. Will they interpret it in terms of going back to the original intent of the authors, the co-sponsors of the legislation, or whether they'll actually take a look at it in terms of its function, its impact on people?
All right. Well, let's move on to another big story this week. The Supreme Judicial Court overturned a firearm conviction of a young black man arrested after fleeing from police. The court ruled that the officers essentially used racial profiling and didn't have the right to stop the defendant based on the vague description they were given, and they couldn't use the fact that the defendant ran from police against him. And its ruling, the court cited a 2014 ACLU report that found blacks were stopped at a disproportionately high rate in Boston compared to whites. The ruling says black men may run from police, quote, to avoid the recurring indignity of being racially profiled. This was a big decision here in Massachusetts. John, what do you make of this ruling?
I think this one is opening up a family-sized can of worms, because what you have is an action that normally would trigger a police chase. And what this ruling is saying is you can't chase these people. And I think that opens up these possibilities for real misinterpretation of what people are doing. Boston Police Commissioner Bill Evans didn't like this ruling at all and said essentially they misread a Boston Police Department study and an ACLU study. But I think that on a common sense level, this makes perfect sense. However, on a day-to-day level and on a practical level, I'm not sure that this is going to actually alleviate the situation. I think this may actually exacerbate it.
Interesting. Well, let's listen to Boston Police Commissioner Bill Evans, who was critical of that ACLU report that the court cited. Here's what he said.
I think relying on a report that is clearly biased by the ACLU, it really bothers me. And, our officers do a great job out there every day taking the guns off the street, and they're going to continue to do that.
Jim, what did you see in this decision?
Well, I would agree with John on that in terms of, even if you think about what's happened in recent days in Charlotte and in Tulsa, you talk to folks who are police officers, and then you talk to folks who are not police officers who are the policed, and it's almost like watching a Rorschach test. So what comes out of this in terms of what it tells the public as to how to behave and how police should behave in situations, it makes it very, very cloudy and hard to, again, functionally think about how the police should do their jobs.
Yeah. Well, as you mentioned, the ruling came out in a week of two more fatal police shootings of black men, one in Tulsa, another in Charlotte. We spoke to retired federal judge and WBUR legal analyst Nancy Gertner, who talked a little bit about the impact that this ruling might have going forward. Here's what she said.
It will force the courts to put in context what we've all been watching on the news and what we've all been reading about, to put in context the profound feeling of illegitimacy that that we have heard about between the police and African-American males. And maybe it'll force the officers to pause before they begin one of these encounters.
What do you think? Do you agree with that, John?
I hate to disagree with someone who has a real legal degree, but I think that the lines on the street during incidents like these are so blurry anyway. And I think that this blurs them even more, and it adds a level of uncertainty. I'm not saying that the court isn't right. I'm not saying that the court isn't wrong. I really don't know where to land on that. But I think that you take a chaotic, uncertain situation and you make it more uncertain. And I think that can only lead to really ambiguous actions on the part of the police. I think it puts them in a really difficult position, but I think the police in many ways have put the public in a really difficult position. So it's a coin flip as far as I can tell.
Mm. Final thought from you, Jim.
I agree with the thrust of what Judge Gertner said in terms of what needs to happen within the police in terms of more training so they actually pause before they take certain actions. What I think is difficult about it is we need to work on the police training and strategies and who they're recruiting. But I don't think we want to actually make it much more hard for them to interpret what a suspect may be doing. We want to make that easier, in fact.
All right. Well, let's move on. Gentlemen, time is we are up against the clock here, and I want to leave time for our hubbubs, those stories that caught your attention but maybe fell below the fold of the newspapers this week. Jim, what's your hubbub?
Well, fall is in the air, and so is music with the opening of the BSO. But today also marks the return of the street pianos.
They seem to be everywhere.
They are everywhere. And the Globe is reporting there are 60 of them in every nook and cranny of Boston, from Athens Bakery in Brighton to Kendall Square in the north, Dudley Cafe in the south, and out to Sullivan's at Castle Island. They're around for about 3 weeks. So if you want to put in earbuds...
Now's the time.
Okay. That's so mean.
Okay, John.
I try them sometimes. I'm lousy.
My hubbub is that there are three illuminated manuscript exhibitions here on display right now in Boston. It's a collaboration of Harvard University's Houghton Library, Boston College's McMullen Museum of Art, and the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. This is the largest exhibition ever presented in North America of medieval and Renaissance manuscripts and early printed books. It's running in all of them, at least through the beginning of December. The one I'm really interested in is the first Florentine edition of Dante's Divine Comedy with illustrations by Botticelli. Hmm. So look for everybody there.
All right, that sounds great.
I'll go with you.
Well, here's my hubbub. It's about the Patriots. I want to just tip my hat to Jacoby Brissett, the third-string quarterback for the New England Patriots, who started last night because Tom Brady, of course, is suspended. Backup quarterback Jimmy Garoppolo was injured. Brissett led the Pats to a 27-0 shutout of the favored Houston Texans. We all know about this. But here's the detail about Brissett that hasn't been widely reported. Last night, he became the first black quarterback to start a game for the New England Patriots in their 56-year history. In fact, he's just the sixth black quarterback to play for the Patriots at all. So another color line gets crossed, another reminder of how long this kind of progress can take. But tip of the hat to Jacoby Brissett, a great game last night. And that's it. Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute, thank you so much for coming in. Have a great weekend. And John Carroll, Professor of Communication at BU and WBUR Senior Media Analyst. Have a great weekend, gentlemen.
You too.
Listeners, stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.